This is KRCU's Going Public, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Missouri became the 28th right-to-work state when Governor Eric Greitens signed it into law earlier this month. The legislation prohibits employers and unions from requiring employees to shell out dues, but the new law hasn't been without opposition from unions statewide. Mark Baker, who is a business representative for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, is against the new law and says it's an attempt to drive down wages. Mr. Baker, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Why are you against the new right-to-work legislation?
Well, it's a political payback for corporate America and uber-rich CEOs to try and weaken unions and basically, effectively, lower the standard of living for all working Missourians.
But what does that mean for Missourians here, their standard of living being changed as a result of that?
The indirect effect of this, and a lot of people may or may not understand this, is that while this legislation targets unions and their members, which roughly in the private sector of the state of Missouri is about 8%, so you could say why would the legislature go after such a small percentage of the population? It has an indirect effect on every working family because the union movement, the labor movement, believes we do set the standards and terms and conditions of employment for all workers. And when you raise the standard through union workers, you indirectly raise the standard for all workers. And we're okay with that. So the inverse is also true. When you lower the standard for union workers, you indirectly also affect all those non-union workers.
And one of the bigger arguments about this right to work for those who are for it is that it is bringing in a lot of opportunity for economic growth, more opportunities for jobs in the area. And one thing that's been said is that some companies will not come to a state that is not right to work. You're not seen as a place worthy, and they'll just kind of, you know, tear up your application and move on. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that's an interesting position to take from a business or a corporate entity. And I think my reaction to that would be, was why is that entity taking that stance? Why would they be so opposed to their employees having an opportunity for representation and a voice on the job? And if they're opposed to that, what type of jobs would they be bringing to the area? And do we want those type of jobs? The hesitation would be, are those living wage jobs, or are they really seeking out a place to establish their facility where wages were lower, workplace incidents could be higher, less safety on the job, less oversight by regulation, regulatory authorities? And I think that's concerning to me. And I'm not really sure we'd have to examine on a case-by-case basis. Would we want those companies here in our state? You know, if we truly believe that all work has dignity, like the labor movement does, and we should respect workers and reward the work that they do, we should provide them a safe job, something that they can go home to their family every night, and it should have a livable wage that you could support, hopefully, a middle-class family on.
What will this legislation mean for unions locally, and more specifically your organization that you, for the workers that you all support?
In a best case scenario, what the technical application of the language does, it takes out the union security clause in a negotiated labor agreement that basically says if you're covered under this contract through your classification that's represented by this labor organization, then you have to become a union of the member within so many days of employment, usually 30, sometimes shorter or longer. Basically, it says that that clause of the contract is now null and void. Somebody cannot be required to join the union even if they're covered under that labor agreement. That's the technical aspect of it. In the best case scenario, every person covered under that contract would still choose to join the union and pay their dues, whatever the structure is, and there would be no effect upon the treasury of the union. The goal of the legislation, we believe, because as it's been pursued by the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Koch brothers, out of state and out of touch millionaires and billionaires, it's to try to encourage members to not join the union and to therefore decrease the treasury of each and every local union of those memberships. The long-term goal of that would be to decrease the treasury funds to where unions couldn't effectively negotiate new contracts, couldn't consider a case to go to arbitration for a member that was unjustly disciplined, terminated, and just give more power to the top 1%. That's the indirect effect. You know, there's somewhere in that spectrum it may land, but our hope and our goal is that it has very little impact if we're successful, but we believe the legislation is just simply a government overreach. All of these union security clauses, they were properly negotiated between the employer and the employee representatives. In my organization, the membership brings forth proposals for every new contract, and then any changes for a new contract are voted on by the membership. All of our officials that serve in the union are elected. We are a democratically controlled organization. You know, everybody has the right to speak up and voice their opinion within our union. The goal would be to weaken our power, and we think that this intrusion by the legislature in Jefferson City, it really attempts to disrupt some very long-term harmonious relations that we've had with our employers for decades. And to our knowledge, these companies are not coming to the table to talk with us about negotiations and saying, we don't like that union security clause. I've been a business representative for over 12 years now. I've never had that conversation with an employer that they said, we don't like that provision in the contract where every one of the people we hire have to become a union member. I think they recognize the give and take on that. Sometimes I'm a liaison to go through them on workplace issues where if they come to me with a reasonable argument or a reasonable position for a situation, we try to be reasonable back and we work with them. You know, we need our companies and our employers to prosper for us to be able to improve our standard of living. And that's the ultimate goal for us.
What do you do for the members who are still paying these dues versus those who aren't going to be paying these dues now?
Well, and that's probably where the unions have the greatest amount of pushback, is because the legislation, it's so unfair. We believe it's unnecessary. The federal level National Labor Relations Act that was passed in 1935, it not only ensures, but it guarantees and forces unions to represent every single employee covered under the collective bargaining agreement, whether or not they pay dues. The union has no ability to not represent those members, and it's referred to in the legal aspect called the duty of fair representation. And we are required to represent those members with no discrimination, whether they're in the union or not. But we feel like that's where it's not fair, because they're not at least paying their portion of the representational fees and the cost associated with doing such.
One thing that's just really interesting to me is that there is a lack of common ground within the unions, where you have those who work, and there are probably unions who aren't in support of it, and then there are those who are in support of it. Where has that communication been dropped at? Like, why is it lost between members within the union?
And I would say the people that have been proponents of this legislation, they've basically done the legislation a disservice by the way they've titled it as right to work. A union contract, or whether a union security clause is in place or not, does not guarantee any person the right to work. We believe everybody in this nation and in the state has the right to get up and go to work.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what they're wanting to say is, you've got the right to work under a collective bargaining agreement without having to pay dues. That's really what the legislation should be titled. You mentioned people in support of it. I'm not aware of any labor organization, or I'm not personally aware of any members that are in support of this, because, and if they are, I'm not saying they're not, I'm just not aware of them. If they are in support of it, I would assume they don't understand the implication of it. It may sound good that I don't have to pay union dues anymore and I still get the same representation, but when you understand the long-term impact of that, we've had conversations with members who've just simply asked for their own education. What does this mean and what will it do? on the backside of those conversations, once we feel like we've explained the technicalities and the goal and the intention, our members walk away very frustrated that Jefferson City has chosen to come in between their employer and themselves in this manner.
Well, the workforce has changed over the last few years. It's not the same as far as, you know, manufacturing jobs. And when we had talked earlier, we were discussing the fact that some individuals within the union may have felt kind of slighted, and they might not have had the same effects post the recession, benefits post the recession that others did. They weren't seeing it, and maybe that was a reason for the miscommunication between those within the union.
I know for the membership that I represent in Southeast Missouri particularly, we have had very few, if any, concessions in our labor negotiations prior to 2008 and since. In a manner, we have had to sit back and evaluate. I don't want to say we did our job too good. That would be a misstatement. But effectively, we're curious, did we insulate our members from maybe what the reality most working families were facing during those times? Did they not feel the effects of the recession like maybe a lot of non-union workers did, that didn't get a pay raise for several years, that maybe had their benefits slashed dramatically? That's a question that we've asked. Now, I do know a lot of local unions that saw their construction slow down, their hiring halls filled back up with members that did not get referred out to work. So I do know some of our union members did feel that. But I think we have to be cautious to say maybe the disconnect in some of our membership is that they don't really know what happened in the real world. And I don't mean to discredit them, but if we're doing our job properly, maybe we have isolated them a little bit from the impact that happened with the downturn in the economy.
We'll hear more on Right to Work after the break.
I'm Ari Shapiro. If you find NPR reliable and comforting, you're not alone. If your old car is a bit less than reliable, well, you're not alone either. Donate your car to us and turn it into the programs you love.
Visit KRCU.org and click on support for all the details.
We're back with KRCU's Going Public, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Before the break, Mark Baker, a business representative for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and I spoke about the pushback from unions on right to work in Missouri. Here's more from our conversation. I want to go back to something that we discussed earlier in the show about the argument that companies won't relocate to an area that isn't right to work. And you found that that isn't always necessarily the case. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I sat up in a Senate hearing a couple of years ago on this right to work issue. And it's interesting that you talk about the proponents of this legislation, and you know they'll bring these jobs into Missouri if we become right to work. Well, there was not one piece of testimony that said this corporation will come in, this business will establish here. So we found that a little bit humorous that they would allege all of these job creators would come to the state, but yet they couldn't name any. And basically what we have found through surveys of companies, what are the things that they look for in relocating a business if they're going to move a location? And what we've traditionally found through a couple of research papers that have been provided to us was, first and foremost, companies look for an educated workforce that's trainable and knowledgeable in the industry or area of which their company exists. Secondly, they want good infrastructure. They want their people to be able to get to work. If they're moving goods and services, they'd like to have several options: rail, water, highways, good roads and bridges. They like to have the strong education system to make sure that their workforce is educated. They always like to look up the ratings or the peer reviews of the school systems that are available. I think the tax increment financing stuff has went away somewhat, but they look for the available workforce. You know, they don't want to go into an area of low unemployment and have to fight for jobs when people are already employed. So I think it makes a lot of sense sometimes to establish in a higher unemployment area because you would have more available people at work. Way down on the list somewhere was, right to work 16th, 17th in that range or something like that. From our perspective and our belief, we don't think employers are traditionally concerned about that. even the proponents will tell you, you know, right to work doesn't do away with unions. It doesn't guarantee that an employer won't have an election for his employees when they establish here. You know, I think the question is, why would they locate here right to work over non-right to work? That's the ultimate question that I've got. So,
all righty then. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
To hear our conversation on right to work in Missouri, visit our website at krcu.org. Anti-abortion groups in Missouri helped boost many Republican candidates to victory in November, and they're now eagerly watching to see how these lawmakers advance their cause. Missouri legislators have since filed dozens of bills restricting abortions, including two that would outlaw abortion after the 20th week of pregnancy, rather than the current 21 weeks and 6 days. Supporters say these kinds of measures protect the unborn, but opponents say they create undue hardships for women. KCUR's Alex Smith reports.
Not long after Rachel Goldberg and her husband were married in the summer of 2015, she felt queasy after a party and decided to take an at-home pregnancy test.
I took the pregnancy test and started brushing my teeth, just thinking like, okay, it's going to come back and say no, and then I can just go to bed and forget about this.
The young couple who raised sheep as a hobby in rural southwest Missouri were eager to start a family, but they didn't expect it to happen so fast.
I looked down at it, and it had the little plus sign and the yes, and I just started screaming.
Early routine testing showed the fetus was healthy, but at 24 weeks, an ultrasound revealed it was not developing as expected. Her perinatologist, Dr. Jeffrey Greenspoon, delivered the news.
I told her that I didn't know if the condition was compatible with life.
The fetus didn't have any of the easily identifiable disorders that standard prenatal tests screen for, but it did have significant genetic abnormalities. If it made it to birth, the baby would likely need extensive and risky surgery just to have a chance of surviving. And even then, it wouldn't have anything like a normal life.
He would have suffered. I mean, that was the bottom line for us. I really wanted a child, and I really wanted a baby, but I didn't think that it was fair for me to ask him to suffer because I wanted a baby.
Rachel and her husband decided to get an abortion, but there was a complication. They didn't find out about the genetic condition until after 21 weeks and 6 days, the point at which Missouri doctors are prohibited from performing abortions unless there's grave danger to the mother. The couple contacted Dr. Warren Hearn of Boulder, Colorado, one of four doctors in the U.S. who perform abortions at Rachel's stage of pregnancy. Because insurance wouldn't cover the procedure, Goldberg had to take out a bank loan to pay for it. She and her husband drove 12 hours to Boulder. The four-day procedure started with the injection of a drug to slow the fetus's heart. It ended with a stillborn delivery. Missouri's current late-term ban is based on when a fetus might be able to survive outside of the womb. The two bills under consideration in Jefferson City would create a 20-week ban based on what one bill's sponsor, Republican Representative Tyler Hubrecht of Dexter, Missouri, says is a developmental milestone.
We want to recognize that children, even in the womb, do feel pain.
The point in pregnancy when fetuses can sense pain has been hard for scientists to pinpoint because pain is a subjective experience and involves complex brain functions. But British and American obstetric groups say a fetus is unlikely to experience pain until at least 24 weeks, if not later. Hubrecht rejects that, saying she's seen other research. She says her Christian beliefs have shaped her views on the sanctity of life, and based on her experiences working with disabled children, she opposes abortion even in the case of severe genetic abnormalities.
Those children still had so much to give to us. You know, they truly have true innocence. And I think as a society, it is important for us to think about those with severe disabilities and realize that how we treat those who are unable to protect themselves tell what kind of society we are.
Late-term abortions have been the focus of lots of legislation and political rhetoric, but they make up a tiny portion of abortions overall. Less than 1.5% of abortions take place at or after 21 weeks, according to the Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights. Typically, the reasons women get them are because they couldn't get access to a clinic, couldn't afford one, didn't realize they were pregnant, or were simply unable to decide. Allison Draith, head of NARAL Missouri, an abortion rights advocacy group, says women who receive late-term abortions often do so because of difficult life circumstances, and that the biggest effect of late-term abortion bans is to create further hardship for them.
So they're not very clear. I mean, I'm not a scientist, so I can't.
At her rural Missouri home, Rachel Goldberg leafs through a big folder full of medical bills, test results, and notes scribbled on the back of pamphlets. She saved these in hopes of appealing her insurance company's denial of her claim. Goldberg had planned on telling people she had a miscarriage, but after returning from Colorado, she confided in a few friends about what really happened, and with their support, she started telling more people, including state lawmakers, about what she'd been through.
It really was an awful time for me. It was the worst thing that I think has ever happened to me, and I was made to feel like this was a terrible decision that I was making when what I was choosing was peace for my son.
Goldberg says she doesn't think she's changed many minds in Jefferson City, but she plans to visit Washington next month to urge national lawmakers to preserve women's access to abortion. For KCUR 89.3, I'm Alex Smith.
That's our show. You can find these stories on our website at krcu.org or find us on iTunes to hear this podcast. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Join me every Friday night at 6 and Sundays at 3 for KRCU's Going Public.